Hi, everyone. My name is Jose Sanchez.
And I'm Jen Toslib.
Welcome to episode 95 of the Criminology Academy podcast, where we are criminally academic. In this episode, we are speaking with Professor Bray Young.
Special topics highlighted in this episode include social support, visitation, and incarcerated teen parents.
Bray Young is an assistant professor in the Department of Criminology and Criminal Justice at Texas Christian University. Her research largely focuses on family and support among offending populations, as well as broader issues within the juvenile justice system. Her recent work has appeared in Justice Quarterly, Journal of Developmental and Life Course Criminology, and Youth Violence and Juvenile Justice.
For this episode, our conversation centers around two journal articles. First, spatial distance as a barrier to visitation for incarcerated youth and why families overcome it, which was co-authored with Jillian Taranovic and published in Justice Quarterly in 2022. The second article is Babies Having Babies, Incarcerated Adolescent Parents and Their Emotional Well-Being, which was co-authored with Bree Diamond and published in Youth Violence and Juvenile Justice in 2024. With that being said, let's bring Bray in.
All right. Thank you for joining us today, Bray. We're really excited to have you on the podcast and to have a conversation with you.
I'm super excited to be here. Thank you guys for having me.
All right. So we want to start by having broad discussion on juveniles and their inherent differences from adults. And so what are some of the challenges that juveniles that become incarcerated face that adults maybe don't experience? And I'm sure a lot of people are automatically thinking, well, it's because the adults are done developing where juveniles are still developing. So it's probably tied to some of that. But can you give us maybe some more specifics on these challenges?
Yeah, sure. I mean, obviously there's the age difference and some of it is, you know, there's a lot of developmental differences between adolescents and adults, but there's also because kids are minors, especially juveniles in the justice system are obviously minors, their legal dependence on family who may or may not be like a good support network and usually socially dependent on those people too. So you're taught, like when we're talking about offering support and stuff for incarcerated kids, their immediate support network might be people who are either very beneficial to them, and that's good because they're reliant on them, or it could be people that are really not so great. And, you know, histories of abuse, neglect, just maybe parents are working a lot, can't be around for the monitoring, whatever that might be. And so you're talking about a group of kids that might have a lot of trauma. Their immediate social support network hasn't been great for them. And so it can be more difficult for a lot of them to trust the adults in the facilities. So you're working against some of that distrust. There's also, of course, going to just be problems with a lot of kids in the justice system are undereducated or have learning challenges. And that's the same kind of in the adult system too. But because kids that are incarcerated are mandated by the federal government to be educated while they're in either a detention facility or in a residential facility, the facilities are going to have to be kind of up against that too. Like they're going to have to be pushing kids towards education, ensuring that they're getting that education because they're mandated to do so. Obviously, just being less developed than adults is going to make it harder for them to process the incarceration experience, even like aside from the trauma and the abuse and stuff that they might have experienced prior to incarceration that can affect how they navigate incarceration, right? Just being underdeveloped, their brain being unable to kind of form some of those connections yet. I mean, the coping skills just aren't there. And so you're talking about a population that might be more volatile, might be more emotionally explosive. So from kind of an interpersonal relationship standpoint within these facilities, like you've got to have people in there that are working, that are trauma informed, that are aware of the challenges of working with kids, all that kind of stuff. I mean, same kind of traumas and abuses and neglect histories and stuff exist for the adult system or people that are in the adult system. But it's such a more proximate issue for kids, right? Because they are enmeshed in their family networks so much. And often when they're released or going back to those family, they don't have the agency like an adult might to go seek out a non-abusive family member to stay with, right? The kids might be having to go straight back into that environment. So we've seen a lot more attunement, I guess, to their larger family dynamics. The juvenile justice system tends to care a little bit more and focus a little bit more on that and at least be more aware of it. So that's always kind of a good thing.
When it comes to incarceration, visitation is, at least I think it's largely viewed by those who are incarcerated and scholars in this area as an important element of the prison or the detention experience, particularly when you have those support systems that are positive and beneficial in nature. And visitation is largely related to this idea of social support that you're talking to, or this perceived or actual tangible forms of support by the community, social networks, and other partners. So going off of this, can you explain why visitation and social support are important for incarcerated individuals and juveniles in particular?
Sure. What book it was, but it was something on the lines of like change occurs in the context of relationships. You have to have kind of a supportive dynamic in order to be rehabilitated, right? Like even, you know, as a parent, when I'm trying to teach my child not to do something they're not supposed to be doing, I do it in a way that's like not punitive, right? It's like, I still love you. You're not in trouble, but let's figure out a solution to move forward together. I think we forget to hold those kind of principles when we are punishing people. We forget that like the best way to change them is to actually like not other them, but to make that like remind them that they're a person and that we care about them. And visits give people that opportunity to see a supportive person, hopefully a supportive person. Not all visits go well for people, but especially kids that maybe aren't used to being away from family. Like an adult has had more time either in and out of the system or just in general to get used to not being around family constantly. But for a child like that maybe lives at home, going to a facility and not being able to see a parent, a guardian, a loved one, that is a jarring experience. And if we're trying to make this person better when they leave the facility than we found them or when they entered the facility, then those opportunities to connect to society are going to be important. It matters though, like who's visiting them. So if it's a person that isn't supportive and the every time that person comes visits, it's a fight, it's an argument, it's that person reminding or the visitor reminding that child like that they did something wrong and harping on like, I can't believe you did this to our family, that's not going to go well. And some kids and adults have actually asked family members not to come visit and don't accept the visits from them because it doesn't help them. It becomes this source of stress. So it can be very beneficial and important just to remind the person that's incarcerated that their family cares about them or their loved ones are there for them. But it can also help them, you know, find someplace to live when they are about to be released or help them find a job or access, like, you know, their parent can help set them up with, you know, getting back into their school in their neighborhood or sign them up for soccer or like whatever, you know, that might be that can kind of help them reestablish themselves on the outside. So it can be very good. It can also be a place that is used for airing grievances or time that's used to air grievances.
So you just mentioned that sometimes they may not want to see their family or they might turn away those visitations. And so that actually gets into the next question that we had, where, you know, like, I think when people think about getting visitations or social support, like it's intuitively, it sounds like it's a good thing, but, you know, it's like people who do this kind of work or the people that have been listening to this podcast will probably be aware by now that things hardly ever operate like that cleanly, or that things operate in like this binary support. No support. But, I mean, I feel like we'd be out of a job if things were that smooth. And so we were hoping that you could tell us a little bit more about maybe like the types of support, you know, how much support, like dosage, like who's visiting them or what other types of support they're receiving, or like what impact this has on people that are incarcerated.
So there's been a lot more research like in the adult system, finding that like visits are pretty beneficial. Obviously, there's some nuance to that. It's not always that they find it's beneficial. In the research I've done with my data from Florida, when I was still a grad student, it's not necessarily as universally beneficial for adolescents, at least in the data set that like I have looked at or used. Most of the time, like for the first part, what you're asking, like who's visiting them, like what does that look like, dosage, that kind of thing. Like most kids are getting visited more often than adults are getting visited. So when I was doing some of those earlier studies with my Florida data, I was looking also at like the Florida Department of Corrections data that like Bill Bales and Dan Mears and some others like had looked at visitation using. And like, I was trying to compare like how frequently Florida adult prisoners versus like juvenile prisoners in Florida or incarcerated persons in Florida were being visited, and kids were just being visited way more frequently. And I think part of that is that reliance on their family, families being more willing to want to come see them. More often than not, it was like a female figure that was visiting. So moms, grandmas, aunts, whenever I looked at like, so of the parents, it was always moms more than dads, aunts and uncles, always aunts more than uncles, grandparents, grandmas versus grandfathers, sisters versus brothers, right? It was always this female figure that was like more willing to come and visit the kids. And then sometimes that gap was like pretty astounding. And like the three, I think two or three most common visitors that these kids were receiving were the female figures like in their lives. In different states, they limit the who can visit adolescents. So they can't get visited by a friend in a lot of states. So if they're part of like the foster care system or something like that, and they don't have a parent, guardian, whoever that could come visit them, they can't get visited by a friend. Their case manager can visit them. A grandparent, if that grandparent is around or willing to visit, can. So it's not going, and some states don't make it that easy for these kids to get a non-family member visitor. Some siblings can come as long as they are over a certain age and like have an ID, you know, with a grandparent. A child is allowed to come, like a baby is allowed to come, but with a family member. And so, you know, and we might bring this up later, but some kids have their own children that are incarcerated. Like while they're incarcerated, they have a baby at home. That baby can't come unless it's a grandparent bringing them, or the mother's child or father is old enough to go on their own. So there's a lot of nuances when we're talking about kids, like who can actually visit them. And it might not be the people who are the most supportive of them are the ones who are able to visit. And so it's just weirder, I guess, than it is in the adult system. And it can be more nuanced, I think, because of that legal dependency and the restrictions that the juvenile facilities kind of have on kids. And then, you know, as far as like some of the effects, I guess, of it being visited, kids that get visited, at least in the studies that I've conducted, they do experience improvements during the course of confinement. Like they're more likely to experience like pro-social changes in things like levels of aggression and, you know, some of the central eight risk factors. I looked at like the different domains that the risk assessment tools give. And I looked at like at the beginning of admission versus the difference at the end of admission. And most kids reduce their risk on almost all domains over the course of confinement if they got visited. But it doesn't really have the effect on recidivism that we would hope that it would have. The kids that were most likely to benefit from visits were the highest risk kids. So the ones that were labeled as high risk to reoffend, they were the most likely to experience that reduction. And that is kind of what you would expect, right? Because they have more room to improve, you know, post-release than a low risk kid or a lower risk kid. So, I mean, from like a policy standpoint, obviously it's important to encourage the visits for X, Y, Z reasons for, you know, facility management, improvement in the facility. But when we're talking about like this long-term effect of visitation, you just don't universally see it. It doesn't necessarily exist. And I don't know if it's just because kids are going back to the same environment that they came from, these criminogenic environments, the friends, the family, the school environment, the lack of like monitoring and compliance and all that kind of stuff that like is just a breeding ground, I guess, for criminal behavior, like what it might be. But there's just what happens in the facility doesn't always translate in the way that you would hope post-release.
Yeah, which is interesting because the research on adults for the most part is showing kind of this recidivism reduction with at least positive visits. So that distinction is interesting.
Yeah. And so when I wrote my dissertation and like most of the findings were null, it was a little frustrating because you're like, I was expecting something a little more interesting than this, but I think it's still interesting because everyone like harps on it so much. And obviously visits are important for a host of other reasons. Like recidivism is not the end all be all like marker of success. I think we tend to narrow it so much. Obviously there's community safety and like economic reasons why we care about this recidivism and like from a victimology standpoint, but like that's not the only thing. Right. That's not a, that doesn't mean somebody's not going to desist later. It doesn't mean that they're not going to be better in other ways. It was kind of surprising and a little disappointing, I think, when I first started like seeing those findings, or not seeing those findings, I guess, really.
Okay, so let's start to move into the first paper we're going to talk about, still kind of thinking in this theoretical space, so not necessarily getting into your results yet. But we know that one of the challenges when it comes to visitation is distance, as in the distance from the individual's pre-detention residence to the actual detention facility. And prisons, thinking in the adult world, are oftentimes in remote areas, and people aren't always sent to prisons that are closest to their families. It's old now, but I think a 2000 study showed that most adults are housed over 100 miles from their pre-prison residence. For juveniles, it's similar in that they may be placed somewhere that's not very close to their families. I don't know if there's an average distance there. If there is, I'll let you talk about that. But can you just give us an overview of what we think, theoretically speaking, when it comes to who is willing or able to visit kids who are in detention facilities?
Yeah. So in the data that I had, it was like the average was 177 miles away from home in Florida. But granted, it takes almost a day to drive from like one end of Florida to the other. Right. So, and but there's a lot of like some of the largest states, like Florida, Texas, California, New York, that have like really large land areas. They house a lot of kids in facilities. So like, this is not like, this is a very applicable and very important figure, like a number, right? So why, like parents, guardians, family, friends, they're going to want to visit, especially their kids, right? They're going to want to visit these young people. I think as a general sense, and this is true from my experience, like law enforcement, courtroom actors, detention facility, like probate, juvenile probation service, like the general public, like everyone tends to view kids as being more amenable to treatment, being a little bit more like sensitive. There's a little bit more care, I think. I think the average person supports like rehabilitation for kids, and like we want to give them a second chance. And so I think family is just generally also going to fall under that umbrella. There's less, I guess there's a smaller amount of time that an adolescent has been in and out of the system and eroding the family dynamics with that, and, you know, losing trust within their family, you know, that in and out and cycling in and out of the system, it really stresses the social support that families are willing to give. Children or parents, family, guardians of adolescents, they haven't necessarily exhausted that yet, especially because their kid is still their legal dependent. So I think family, just as a general rule, is more willing to visit and overcome some of those barriers, like distance and traveling. The problem with some of it is like, we don't have, a lot of juvenile facilities don't offer like the bus services that some states offer to go to like adult correctional facilities. And so the challenges of getting there, I mean, there's tangible challenges to getting to a facility, right? Those are like not having transportation, not being able to take off work, the hours that the facility allows visits, you know, it can be a couple of hours in the middle of a week, or it could be a couple of hours on a Saturday or Sunday. It could be in the evening. It could be like in the morning when you're, you know, you have to take your kid, the other kids to school, not having childcare, right? And then of course, there's just the emotional burden that some visits take on the family members. I mean, and this, the security of the facilities, the dress code, all of that kind of stuff is not always expected by family members. And I think just navigating that process is a lot. And so to go, especially if your family member is housed, like, so 177 miles, I'm trying to think, that's like almost 4 hours, maybe, like depending on like the kinds of, how fast you're allowed to go, like depending on the kind of roads you're taking to get there, that's a long time. So you're talking an entire work day to get just in traveling. You're talking like 8 hours, not to mention the amount of time you have to sit and wait for the hours, the visiting hours to start, the time that you're spending there. If you've got to like go to any bathroom breaks, any dinner breaks, like all that, you're talking a full day, sometimes longer for families. The average person that's incarcerated does not come from a well-off family. They don't come from a family that has a full-time salaried position with time off that they can take to go visit their kid and have the transportation and the money and money for childcare for their other kids. Like that is not the average experience, right? It is an indigent family that maybe their kid had a public defender. They don't have their own access. They don't have reliable access to transportation. They're working an hourly job. that requires them, you know, if they take off, they lose that money. You know, that's a lot of considerations. And that, you know, that's obviously true for people that are incarcerated in the adult system too. But, you know, we're talking about like for juveniles, like most of the parents, guardians of adolescents that are incarcerated also have other children that they've got to take care of. And they're not retired yet. So they can't just like go off and visit, you know, their children that are incarcerated, things like that. I mean, it's just an added layer of complication for this group. Does that hit on what you wanted me to talk about?
Yeah, I find this stuff really fascinating. I actually, one of my areas on my comps was social support and visitation because my dissertation was supposed to be on it. The data ended up falling apart, thanks COVID. But you hit on a point that I just wanted to ask you just a little bit more because I know some of the work that's been done on it with adults, but I don't know how it works for juveniles. This idea of kind of secondary prisonization, where when people are going to do the visits, they almost feel like they are themselves entering the facility and being, you know, put into an incarcerated setting, which can make people more hesitant to visit, like you mentioned. Do we see that with juveniles then too? Like that their visitors are talking about experiencing this feeling, or is it different because the facility and security levels?
I don't know that anyone's explicitly studied it. So there you go, Jen.
There you go.
I don't know that anyone's explicitly said it. I mean, from like a philosophical standpoint, the juvenile facilities are supposed to be less locked down and less secure in some ways. Now, that's not a universal truth because I know in Texas, for example, there's like the TJJD facilities that like high level security facilities, and they look more like an adult facility than like a residential treatment center would be. So I think maybe it depends too on the type of facility that families are going to. I mean, I can speculate, but I don't know for sure what that answer is. I mean, there's still dress codes. So, you know, I know family members in the adult system have complained about like either weren't aware of something or they thought, like, because I think in some of the dress codes, it says stuff like just modest clothing or something. Well, my idea
what does that mean?
Is different than someone else's idea of modest. Like, well, I'm covered, but like your belly button is showing. And like, didn't think anyone was going to be offended by their shoulders or something. So they don't know when they get there, or they have to have an ID. And the ID is, you know, they're 16. Maybe they should have some sort of ID, but they don't. And so these rules and restrictions, I think, I don't know that it's always just the built environment that makes them feel like or have that secondary kind of experience. I think it's the rules and the regulations. And like, I mean, you're going through a metal detector and you might have your shoes come off, and like, it's more intensive than like TSA, no offense to our TSA agents out there, but like the prison guards do a better job, like patting you down. And like, you feel like, cause I went and visited an adult prison in Texas recently. And like, I felt like I was literally like patted down, and like I had to hand over my ID and they scanned my shoes. And I was like, good thing I have clean socks on. Like I've just been like expecting like all of this. And then the metal detector, and every time you walk through a door, you hold up your ID. And like just some of that process, I can see why people would feel that way. Like I can see why. And if the juvenile facilities are operating like that, then for sure. I mean, I can definitely see that that would happen. It's just a lot of rules, and they're there for a reason for sure. But I can see why people would feel, I can definitely, from my own recent experience going.
Yes, they definitely get friendly with you.
Yeah, I'm like, it's kind of a massage. You're like, It just was not expecting that. Like, I don't know what I was expecting, but it wasn't that.
All right, so let's get into the first paper that we're going to be discussing today. It's titled Spatial Distance as a Barrier to Visitation for Incarcerated Youth and Why Families Overcome It. It was co-authored with Jillian Taranovic and published in Justice Quarterly in 2022. And so for this paper, mentioned this, you used data from Florida's Department of Juvenile Justice to study how factors such as household income may influence visitation for incarcerated juveniles, regardless of how far they are from their families while incarcerated. And so our first question for you is, what was the motivation behind this paper? And so what gaps were you filling with this paper?
Sure. So, okay. This particular paper, I actually came up with it because Jill Tranovic was teaching a manuscript writing class and I had to come up with a topic. And I was like back and forth, like a couple of different things. And I was already like writing the dissertation, like kind of figuring or starting to write it, kind of figuring out like what the landscape was of what we did know, which is not a lot on juvenile visitation and in all my models, like distance from home was always significant. And it was always like a 1.01 like odds ratio or something, or like, you know, really small, but it was like every mile, right, was increase or decreasing the odds of being visited, or it was like, so it was like 0.99, the odds ratio. And so it was like really, really small. And I'm like, but there's still kids that are getting visited, right? The odds ratio and like the significance, like, I'm like, what is going on with these kids that whose families are overcoming it? Because I know, and I think I was mostly thinking from my own perspective, I'm like, if I was incarcerated, number one, my mom would have killed me already. So like, I know wouldn't have been eligible for visits, but like, yeah, if I was incarcerated as a kid, I don't think my parents would have cared how far it was. And I know they had the means to be able to do the traveling. And so we were kind of just talking about it. I'm like, what? I love the idea of kind of figuring out like, what doesn't fit an established pattern, right? Like the pattern is people that are housed farther from home are not receiving visits, but like there's always exceptions. Like our odds ratios and our coefficients, they're showing like more often than not, this is what's happening. And here's the magnitude of that effect, right? But there's obviously going to be people that don't fit that pattern. So what is going on there? And so I just happened to kind of look into like, you know, what percentage of kids are these negative cases, right? They're receiving a visit, even though based on how far they are from home, they statistically shouldn't be receiving that visit. And so it was really, the idea came out of necessity because I was taking that class and which 10 out of 10 recommend that class. It was incredible. And, you know, just kind of like just figuring out like what I was interested in understanding, like what are these nuances of like this visitation experience that we're not capturing yet. And so that's kind of where it came from. And it just honestly was like the most fun I've ever had writing a paper, first of all. And it just like flowed out. Like it was probably the easiest paper that I've written from the standpoint of like being able to sit down and do it and write it. And it was just like, I don't know. I just found it like so fun. Maybe it's because Jill is like a 10 out of 10 co-author and she's just incredible, but it was just fun. Like I really liked it. And I think I look back on it and I still think it's like one of my favorite like papers that I've written. I don't know if I just gave you anything that you asked for.
No, that would, and you know what they say, right? Necessity is the mother of invention. Right? True. So, yeah. And you got a pretty good paper out of it. So, you know,
pretty shocked about it too. I'm just saying. We really wanted this title to be like, are we there yet? ? And it just didn't pan out. I don't think the reviewers liked it too much, but I loved it. We were like all into it. And when we had to cut it, it was like the saddest day of our lives. Cause I'm like, that is the issue. It was cutesy, but it was like, we're talking about kids. They're like the, are you there yet? Which is like the constant like nagging that the kids do on car rides. I'm like this, I don't know. I still stand by that as a title.
I mean,
we can retitle it in this episode.
Yeah. But we also know that statistically, while they're traveling to visit, someone's sibling in the car asks that question.
100%. Somebody asks it, always. So, I mean, I think we could, it's a non-zero probability that like, I'm still bummed about it, but I will just keep referring to it as that paper, the Are We There Yet paper.
Yeah. So in your Are You There Yet paper, you focused on factors like income, parent-child closeness, and family support, and these whether or not they were related to overcoming long distances and visitation. What were your key findings in this study?
Yeah. So obviously the kids that were housed farther from home, less likely to receive the visits. But when we like looked at the kids that were, I believe it was like 200, the cutoff was like 200 miles from home or something was considered far from home, was like over the average. The kids that were housed really far from home, but were still good at receiving visits, were receiving them if their families had more income. So higher household income meant that their family was more able to overcome the distance, which makes a lot of sense for a lot of reasons, right? You know, you see people with higher incomes, they probably do have jobs that they can take off from work to visit a family member, assuming visits are during the week. They can take that time off and still be able to feed their families at the end of the month. They probably have reliable transportation. They can afford the gas that it takes to get there. the snacks that you get on the way and lunch and dinner and maybe hotel stays if that's what's necessary. And then the other thing was closeness. So when there was a greater parent-child closeness, they were more likely to overcome that barrier. And so, you know, obviously having that tangible income is going to be important, but some families are able to overcome that simply because they care a lot about their child. And obviously, you know, there's plenty of parents that really, really care about their kid and still couldn't overcome that barrier for childcare reasons, income, whatever that might be. But those were the two main ones that we saw, was that closeness and income. The more of both of those that you had, the greater odds that you were going to be able to overcome distance as a barrier.
Which makes sense. Thinking of my own parents, they also would have killed me, yeah, but they sure definitely would have, you know, in the off chance they hadn't killed me, they would have for sure come to see me.
In the slim chance that you survived going through the justice system. Yeah. And I think that was kind of where we started, was just from obviously our own lenses of like, what do we think would be, and like theoretically, obviously it made sense. We pulled a lot from prior research on like the barriers to visitation and like, you know, just not having close family or, you know, like not being close with your family, not having a lot of money. Those were all cited as barriers. So like just kind of figuring out how they stack on one another or mitigate the effects of one another. It panned out the way we kind of expected it to, but another, like I still thought it was really interesting to see that, especially because these kids, a lot of them are housed really far from where they live. And, you know, in Florida in particular, I know a lot of other states do this too. When they incarcerate an adolescent, a lot of these facilities, the residential treatment facilities, specialize in certain groups of kids. So it might be like a male sex offender facility, but that facility might not be even remotely the closest one to that kid. So they might be housed even farther than an adult would be, where maybe they're just being housed on risk level and the security level that they need. Whereas the kids are being housed based on security level, potentially this, their sex, but then also like any particular like needs that they have. So once you like whittle it down, there might only be one facility that could house that kid. It might be in the panhandle of Florida and they're from Miami. And so you're talking like an 8 to 9 hour trip just to get there. How much money you got to have to overcome that, right? You got to really love your kid to get all the way up there. You know, it can be really daunting. I mean, that's a lot.
That's a long ways. A lot of money, a lot of time, a lot of energy, you know.
I think by the time I get there, I don't love my kid anymore. I'm like, it's a long drive.
I mean, I'm going to turn around.
Yeah. Well, I think I just really don't love road trips. So I'd probably be like staring at my kids like, number one, how dare you? Number two, I come all the way this way. Like that is just hurts me in so many ways.
Yeah. Well, and then from California. So I'm just thinking like, I can guarantee you, my dad would be like, you know how much gas costs right now in California? Yeah, I'm not paying $6 a gallon to go see you.
For a mistake that you made. Yeah. Especially because I wanted to kill you when it first happened and I didn't.
Oh, so yeah.
You're lucky you're alive. Yeah.
It has. I know we'll talk about it, but I think that study also has some really interesting policy implications related to those elements. But we'll get to that
for sure.
Yeah. So for now, we want to shift gears a little bit away from social support and visitation for incarcerated juveniles to incarcerated teen parents. Right. So we want to set the stage with this broad discussion on teen parenthood. And at least to me, it seems like this has cooled down a little bit, but it may be because I haven't been a teenager in over a decade. So I may just not be aware of it anymore.
It's not a pressing social problem in your life anymore.
Yeah. So I don't know if that's just why I don't hear about it as much as I think when I was a teenager back in the early 2000s, it seemed like it was all over the place. Like, you know, like my parents would have these conversations with me. And so basically want to start out with this conversation. Like, is it still a major issue in the US? Are like teen pregnancies and teen parenthood still a pressing issue in the United States?
I mean, statistically, no, not really. I mean, the teen birth rate for adolescent girls between like 15 and 19, because 19 would be like the end of when you can be considered an adolescent, like mom, just under 14 per 1,000, right? And it was like back in like the 60s was really when we first started seeing higher rates of It was unwed teen parents. That was what started the real concern over it. Nobody really cared if a later teenage person got married and had a child, whether or not that child came before or after the proposal didn't matter, right? It was like that was happening in the birth was happening in the context of marriage. So just to like kind of back up a little bit, like in the 60s-ish, a lot of women started going to college, delaying marriage. And so more births were happening outside the context of marriage. That's when people started being like, oh my gosh, like what is going on? Like, why are these children wild? The children are not all right. Like what's happening here? And the teen birth rates were pretty high. Like they were, I can't remember the exact figure. It was like, think 2 to 3 times higher than like maybe what it is right now. And so now we're at this point where like it has dropped drastically, but the birth rate in the country has also drastically. I think in a lot of circles, it is still something that they're actively trying to prevent because there can be at least short-term implications of being an adolescent parent. Usually, if there's long-term effects of being an adolescent parent on like future life outcomes, it has to do with something in the background that happened, some sort of spurious association. Like they were already disadvantaged in some way before they got pregnant or, you know, became a father, whatever. So it's still being talked about a lot, but there's more recognition, at least within like scholarly circles, that teen pregnancies are not universally a bad thing. We shouldn't be necessarily encouraging it because we want kids to like figure out who they are first, but there are populations where the kids are very much wanted, that they're not actively prevented, that when it happens, it is a sign of like femininity or masculinity, and it's tied to that. And it isn't viewed as this negative thing the way that I think society tended to view it, you know, in the early 2000s and even before that point. And maybe it is because I am also very removed from that was like half my life ago at this point, but like I was an adolescent, like it did feel like a bigger deal. But I think also around the time that I was a teenager, those shows like Teen Mom popped up and it felt like people were glorifying being a teen mom. Right. And that is a concern that gets brought up all the time, like with those kinds of shows, is that they're glorifying it. And I'm like, just spend a day in my house. You're not going to be a teen parent. Like I had 2 4-year-olds running around, like trial by fire. Like you are not going to want to do this. So I think seeing it on TV, like, I don't know if that's why like people started like really talking about it again. But as a general sense, a lot of what the discussion of teen pregnancy and parenthood is now is prevention. And that's a lot of federal funding has shifted from supporting teen parents if they do become parents with like welfare, alternative schools, stuff like that, to now it's just like prevention. It's like, let's just prevent it. And then once the child arrives, like it's a different story. Now, with Roe v. Wade being overturned and adolescents being in a lot of states limited in any option that they might have if they become a teen pregnant human, like, I don't know, like what that conversation is going to continue to look like. If we start, we might see rates of teen pregnancies increase drastically again. And so if that is the case, it might become more of a renewed conversation. Now it's not, like I said, it's not totally been abandoned, but no, I just don't see that kind of discourse the same way that we were seeing it a couple decades ago.
Yeah. And so you touched upon some of the reasons why people saw it as a negative thing. And like, I even remember like when my parents would talk to me about it, they'd basically be like, if you have a kid right now, it's going to ruin your life. I mean, sometimes my dad would still be like, you should have finished school before having your kid. And I'd like tell him, you told me to get a college degree. I had 2 before I had my kid. So yeah. Technically, I met your stipulations.
Yeah, for sure. You didn't specify how much college I needed to finish.
Yeah, you just said I needed a degree.
Yeah,
so, and I go. Yeah, and I got 2. So, but you know, it's like this idea like a kid's a lot of responsibility. It's, yeah. You know, it's like you're going to have to drop out of school and start working. At least that's what my parents kept telling me. Mm-hmm. So can you tell us more about the consequences and the negative or positive of becoming a teen parent and maybe compare how a regular teen parent versus one that becomes incarcerated and like some of the differences between those two?
Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly not like this, like, well, like world renowned expert on like adolescent parenthood, but I've kind of started to get a sense of like, at least the differences between kids that are not justice system involved, that have their own child versus those that are. Now, one thing, like for the longest period of time, like most of the research was kind of universally saying, like you're a teen parent, you're going to have lower earning potential, more likely to drop out of school, mental health problems. Like, and we still see a lot of that, but more recent studies have been able to kind of account for these pre-existing disadvantages that a lot of teen parents have, like trauma, abuse, coming from a neighborhood that just didn't have a lot of jobs, or, you know, having lower education, like histories in the family. Like once we could account for a lot of that, or even looked at like sibling dyads, like stuff like that, like it, the effects aren't as strong. And if the kids are going to have problems, if they're a teen parent, it usually doesn't extend throughout the life course. So it's going to be like their early 20s. They might be kind of behind a little bit in some ways, but for the most part, you get to your 30s, your 40s, your 50s, like you're not going to see these like lasting effects, but that's for like the general population. We don't really know that much about kids that are involved in the justice system that have their own children. Now there's a number of like qualitative studies and some like quantitative studies that have looked at it, but it's mostly like with respect to crime, or there's some like really great qualitative work that's looked at like teen fathers that are incarcerated and like their identity as a father, how they like how much they want to be involved. And so what I've kind of seen is that when we look at whether it's the general public or incarcerated kids that are parents, it's very gendered. The experience is gendered because more often than not, unwed parents in general, but especially teen parents, the mom is going to be the primary caretaker of that child. And they do, in some ways, if we're talking from the like father's perspective, like the mom will gatekeep access to that child, especially if the father is incarcerated. And, you know, there's some, so it is harder for the fathers that are incarcerated as an adolescent to maintain contact with their child and to be enmeshed in the lives of their child, unless they're financially providing for them. That usually offers like kind of an inroad, but if they're incarcerated, they cannot financially provide anything necessarily. For both males and females that are, you know, teen parents, like there's going to be the challenge of just navigating these different identities, right? You're an adolescent, which we all know is like the most horrible time ever. Like lots of hormones, lots of feelings, lots of just trying to figure out where you fit in the world. Then you are a teen parent, which I became a parent at like 29, and it was still like this navigate, like just what am I supposed to do here? Like, who am I? Like, how do I reconcile like who I was 2 months ago with the person I am now? So you're doing that as an adolescent who has fewer coping skills to maybe navigate that. And then on top of that, if you're incarcerated, you have to navigate that label of being incarcerated and being a parent and an adolescent all at the same time. So there are a lot of, there's been some qualitative work that has found that like teen thought, and this is mostly been conducted on teen fathers, they've kind of rejected their parental identity just to survive in the facility. They'll say no visits from family. They're just kind of prisonizing themselves to survive. They're just kind of cutting out any sort of other identity. It's a lot for anyone to deal with these three kind of competing identities. And so found that, you know, some kids are just not doing as well if they're teen parents, like while they're incarcerated, because that is challenging to navigate all these different competing identities. You know, some work has kind of found that fathers in particular have to make really difficult choices when they're like putting people on their visitor log. So like if you're a teen father and you want your child to come visit you, they're going to have to come with like the mother, right? But in some states, I think it was California, at least from the study at the time that this was written, this was their policy. It was like in California, you could only have one significant other listed. But if your significant other is not the same person as the mother of your child, you now have to pick between your girlfriend coming to visit you or boyfriend, whoever that might be, versus like the child of your parent who has custody. And so it's this weird situation that like you probably wouldn't run into in the adult system, where like as long as it's an approved visitor, you could get that person in there. But with kids, they limit it so much, they're having to make these choices between like seeing their child, seeing the person that they are in a relationship with. And I'm sure that that dynamic is even more complicated, you know, if their child's in foster care or their child lives with like a grandparent who can't come visit, or like whatever these complicated dynamics might be. You just, you know, it can get really hairy for the kids that are trying to navigate this, and they just don't have the coping skills to deal with it. So not the same way that, I mean, I don't think anyone would be able to deal with all of that at one time very well, let alone like a 15, 16, 17 year old kid.
On top of just the fact that they are incarcerated and trying to deal with that alone, I can't even imagine being like a 15 year old who is in a detention center. And then you add on this fact that I'm also a mom, like at 15, like that's just, that's almost like, too much.
If you really want to be a parent and like, you can't be around your kid, I mean, that's what kind of stress and like just turmoil does that create? I mean, and if you want to be involved in like the caretaker of your child, whether it's your child's mom or dad, or like your parents, like won't bring them mm-hmm. for one reason or another, like then you can't even see them. I mean, that's very hard. Like that has to be probably one of the hardest situations to be in as a parent, would be an incarcerated teen parent. Like it just, but really we don't see a lot of research on it, like at all. There's some in like other disciplines, like family child sciences, like they've looked at it a bit, but really like on average, we don't really know a lot about this group of kids at all. It doesn't even like, there was an OJJDP like solicitation for money recently about this topic. And it's like the first thing I've seen on this at a federal level in a, like, if ever, like, I don't know if I have at all from this point.
Wild. Well, speaking of that, you've done some research on this. So we're going to talk about your paper, Babies Having Babies, Incarcerated Adolescent Parents and Their Emotional Well-Being. It was published in Youth Violence and Juvenile Justice in January of this year, 2024, and co-authored with Bree Diamond. So for the study, used the same data from the Florida Department of Juvenile Justice that we discussed in the previous paper. And for this paper, you focused on the impact of parenthood on incarcerated juveniles. So just like before, we want to start off by asking you, what was the motivation behind writing this paper? I'm guessing it has something to do with the fact that there's not a lot of research on this. But
yeah, pretty much. And I was just trying to, I don't even know where the idea to look at this population came from. I have no idea why I even started. Like, I think I was looking through the risk assessment tool. Maybe I stumbled upon a variable in it that just asked about the status of their parenting. And I think I had always chalked it up to, because I had looked at this, like it was at the time called the RPACT assessment, the Residential Positive Achievement Change Tool. And that is like what a lot of the data that I have used like incorporates. And I think originally, maybe I just assumed it was like the status of their parents' parenting on them. And then I think I realized like, this is actually like talking about whether they have their own kid. And so I saw that like within the data that I had, it was like 7.5% of my sample had a child. And that amounted to of like, the analytic sample that I can use, 558 or something like that. Within a 5-year period, there was like almost 600 kids that were incarcerated that had their own child that they knew about, right? That's of course like and kept. And I'm sure that there's a lot more that they didn't admit to having a child. They didn't know, they terminated, like any of that kind of stuff. So like, what is happening with this group of kids? And I guess maybe because I am a mom, I was curious, like, what would be their emotional adjustment to the facility if they were separated from their child? So I looked at with Bree Diamond, Bree and Bray always gets people tripped up. Yeah. We introduce ourselves. We looked at like using their initial risk assessment tool, like which is 30 days after admission is the maximum amount of time that can lapse before they have to get this assessment. And so we looked at mental health diagnoses and like suicide attempts within that time frame for parents versus non-parents. And then we looked at it for moms and dads like separately. We were just interested in kind of exploring what's happening with this population and at minimum get a sense of how many and like what was the percentage of kids that were incarcerated that had their own child. Like with, I couldn't even find, there's like some, you know, studies like goes between 7% and 30%. And I'm like, I mean, that's what a range.
Nice range.
What are we looking at here? Yeah. So I was just curious, like I wanted to get like a baseline sense. And it just kind of, the more I was looking into it, I'm like, let's figure out like their emotional adjustment first. So that's basically, well, we did it.
And you know, like Jen mentioned, the goal of the study was to assess how parental status is associated with incarcerated youth's emotional well-being during their confinement. So what did you find? Like, what were the key takeaways of your study?
So mostly it was an association between teen parenthood and suicide. It was attempted or it was attempted suicide. It was, we were able to like break, originally we just looked at like suicide as like a marker period, whether they threatened it or attempted it. And that was significantly associated with it. But then we broke it out by like threatening to attempt suicide and actually carrying it out. And it was more so that they were threatening it and like verbalizing this discomfort with like being separated from their child and like threatening self-harm versus actually carrying it out, which thankfully was the case. But that association was much stronger for the moms than it was for dads. So these girls were like, I think it was like 4 or 5 times like more likely to attempt or like threaten suicide than non-moms, non-teen moms. And I mean, it wasn't a shocking surprise, like finding at all. I mean, I think maybe again, because I am a mom, I'm like, I get it. Like, I understand that emotional like connection you have with your child and like that separation is hard. So yeah, it was mostly the young girls were really struggling in that initial period of confinement. We did not look at like over time, whether or not that improved. I was really just curious, like what's happening in that immediate period right after incarceration, when how they settle in can matter, how they're acting and behaving can set the tone for the rest of their stay. Yeah, that's pretty much what we found. So fortunately, at least in the data that we had, it wasn't them actually carrying out these suicide attempts, but really threatening it more so than anything.
This distress element, it kind of seems like distress for being apart.
Yeah, for sure. And again, I don't know how it would look if you kind of looked at it over time, like if that improves or not. I mean, for the most part, like I think we did control for like pre-adjudication levels of like mental health and suicide risk. And that was, you know, that finding still emerged after even accounting for predispositions towards that. So, I mean, we're pretty sure it's this like parent effect that's having, but, you know, when you see when it's affecting mental health, like depression or anything else, like, or obviously suicide is this manifestation of like other problems. If we don't take care of that while they're incarcerated and like focus on these parents that are coming in, like not only is it posing like a safety issue, security issue in the facility, but like, we don't want to make them worse, right? We try to provide the services and the supports. That separation from their child isn't as like jarring.
All right. So you just kind of started to go into it, right? Let's keep the ball rolling. But yeah. Given everything that we've discussed today, so about visitation, about teen parents who are incarcerated, what implications are there for future research and then also policy and practice?
Sure. So I think we just need to know more about, especially the teen parents that are in the justice system. I think it just needs to be more, there needs to be more attention paid to it. I'm sure that more facilities than I'm aware of have programming for those kids. You don't see a lot of it like listed on websites and things like that. It's just not emphasized. Like it's not part of a lot of the discussions. And so I think just drawing attention to the fact that there are parents, not just in the adult system, but in the juvenile system, especially that have very young children in a very malleable like stage of life and of stage of development that are being separated from their parents. The conversation cannot just be all about like these adult incarcerated people with their young or even like older children, right? We have, especially adolescents, their children are probably no more than five. Like just statistically speaking, like unless they started like way younger than I can anticipate, like you're talking children between 0 and 5, like maximum. And so just being aware of it is obviously going to be important. And there's just so many directions for research on that area. I think looking at programs that are available for teen parents, especially validating them, figuring out what's going on, how are they being offered? There really needs to be like interviews, focus groups with kids that are incarcerated or even on probation that are teen parents. Like, how are they navigating it? What supports are they receiving? I mean, from like a policy perspective, like the most ideal situation would just be never separating children from their parents, right? This pie in the sky idea. We know that like sometimes the incarcerated parent leaving is not a bad thing. Like it can be good. That can be a traumatic parent to the children that are left behind. And like their removal is for the benefit of the family. For the average person, right, it's still going to be a challenge. And I mean, there's never going to be a time when we can completely keep every parent that violated the law in the community. That's just not going to happen. But to the extent that we can do that is always going to be the first priority. But if we have to incarcerate a kid that has their own child, I think that as a general rule, kind of tying it back to the visitation stuff too, like there needs to be something there, something in place to help keep families united, whether it is free phone calls, which we know are monetized to death in these facilities, free Zoom, Skype, whatever, like FaceTime, I don't care what it is, right? Like whatever that looks like, so they can talk to their loved ones, whether it's subsidizing buses or plane tickets or whatever. I mean, I know here, the county I live in is Tarrant County, and their juvenile probation services, if they have to house a kid too far from home, especially out of state, the juvenile probation service helps fund their travel to visit their child. It is not an unreasonable expectation that these kids could get that kind of support. I know it's expensive, you know, but I just, the benefit, I think, of maintaining that connection, even if it's not always reducing recidivism, it can still make these kids better. It can help form a connection. I mean, there's simple, like, I recently learned that every inmate in Texas receives a tablet when they're incarcerated. And I'm sure that that is going to get the people going, but like they get this tablet and they can make like, I mean, they have like work duties and stuff like all day, but they can FaceTime and like video chat with their family, like pretty much anytime that they're in their cell and they have access to their tablet. And I'm like, what a lovely idea. Like, it's just, I know it's, but like, it is so nice. Like they feel like a human that can have that connection, like with their family. But of course, like if I always, my caveat is always like, well, if the family dynamics are terrible, like let's fix that, right? Let's try to get families involved. Like there's really well-established programs like functional family therapy that work really well. And it doesn't just work to like improve family dynamics, but it reduces reoffending. It helps these family members like be really supportive, but it's costly, right? It's costly on top of the incarceration. It's costly on top of offering like all these other services. But, you know, I think something I've really started like considering a lot is just this value ratio, right? Like how much money do we save for every dollar we contribute to education, to functional family therapy, or whatever that might be? And we tend to save exponentially more by investing in some of those programs, even if it doesn't sound like something that a lot of people want to get on board with for one reason or another. I'm like, but the money, right? The money we can save is like really good. So I guess just like a lot more attention. And I think my thread through all of like, I think my policy implications is always just reminding people that these are human beings, right? The people that are incarcerated are still people. And just when we're talking about kids, they're still kids. They did something bad. That doesn't make them a bad person. That doesn't mean that they're, you know, they, we should be othering them and separating them from our community. They're still going to be your neighbor. They're going to be your kid, the kid behind you at the grocery store, or like walking down the sidewalk, walking to the neighborhood park. Like they're going to be, when they grow up, maybe the person doing work inside of your house, like any, or, you know, at your bank teller, like whatever it might be, like that person is going to be a part of our community. And if we invest in them the way that we invest in these physical buildings that incarcerate them, we wouldn't have to incarcerate people to the same extent. You know, just investing in those personal relationships, whether it's a relationship between family and their child or the staff and the children in the facility, like whatever, just improving this, making it a supportive dynamic, even if it's incremental steps, like here's a bus ticket to get to visit your child, right? That is just building the slow foundation of like a social net around the family and the kid, and like, maybe it'll make everyone better. Maybe it'll be expensive, but like, maybe it'll be great. You know, like, I think maybe that's just my like bleeding heart, like set of policy recommendations and like my pie in the sky ideas. But like, I mean, that's what research tells us works, is investing in people and doing it in a way that's supportive. So, I mean, at the end of the day, like that's going to be the best strategy, or at least a good strategy, if not the best one, right? Which is how I see it.
For sure.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, no, like I always hate having to like put dollar signs on anything, but
I know,
unfortunately, it is something that does matter. And you know, I'm actually doing some work right now where it kind of shows that money does matter to people. Like we used a vignette and we randomized whether they were told how much it costs per year to incarcerate someone. And we saw that once that dollar sign was put into the vignette, support for incarceration just like plummeted. So
not surprised by that at all.
No. Like, yeah, we're like, you know, it costs taxpayers X amount to incarcerate someone per year. And they're like, nope, let's not incarcerate people.
There's definitely a coalition of people that are punitive, but also fiscally conservative and want to save tax money. And that financial like cost benefit analysis and like showing those figures, I think can help inform a population that is more centered on like, what is this going to cost us? Like, I always view like rehabilitation and stuff as being two like different camps, like helping the person and helping the economy. And both of those things can happen when we're talking about like rehabilitation. Like both of those things can matter. And what lens you take and how you describe it, I think just depends on your audience, right? If you want to convince somebody of rehabilitation and they care more about the dollar sign, here's your research. If they care more about like, how do we fix this person? How do we make them part of our community? Well, here's your other like set of facts that you start presenting them. And I'm actually teaching a class on offender rehabilitation. And I do that in my class. I'm like, okay, here's how this is going to benefit this human being. And here, how much it's going to benefit your tax money. Like, because it is, I mean, they go hand in hand. They're both important. Like it's both part of a conversation. And I think, yeah, people just need to know how much stuff is costing them. And I don't think there's always that transparency of how much money anything costs. It's like, this just let other people handle the cost of these things. Like, I'm just worried about the outcome, like of whether or not this person is incarcerated or not. I don't care like how much it costs me. So keep doing it, Jose. Tell them all. Tell everyone. Shout it from the rooftop.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Bray, those are all the questions that we had for you today. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to speak with us.
This was fun.
Yeah, it was an interesting conversation for sure.
I was just going to say, when you sent the articles you wanted to talk about, I was like, yes, this is going to be good. Right up my alley.
And I feel like people get this all the time, but like you ask researchers about their research and they're just like, oh, like, please sit down. Like, I'm going to tell you everything that you need to know. Like, you have like this one audience of people that actually want to hear what you have to say. Because I don't know about you guys, but I feel like sometimes my research just goes into the ether and it's only ever read by other people who are going to write papers that also go out into the ether. And so when you can like have the conversations and be able to talk about it in a way that's not like very methodological or anything, and you can just be fun with it, it's really nice. Like, it's nice to have people hear your like research and stuff.
For sure.
It was really fun. Yeah. Thanks for having me, guys.
Okay. So, and then is there anything you'd like to plug? Anything we should be on the lookout for in the near future?
Well, I'm doing some more stuff on teen parents. I am almost finished with a paper where I surveyed probation officers in a large county in Texas, which shall remain otherwise unnamed, and asked them about their experience supervising teen parents on their caseload and like how many kids they have on their caseload that are pregnant or parenting and like, what do they do when they handle them? So that should be submitted. It was going to be the end of spring break, hopefully next week. And then I've got just some other stuff, just looking at using Pathways to Desistance data with Kristen Lloyd, shout out, looking at parents in that sample and like some of their outcomes. So a lot of this stuff is under review or about to be under review. So, but that's kind of what's going on in the future.
Awesome. And if people have any questions, where can they find you?
They can find me at TCU, at Criminology and Criminal Justice Department. My email is bray.young@tcu.edu. I do have social media, but I hardly use Twitter or X, whatever we want to call it. So you can find me on there, but I'm not on it that often. But I do exist on that platform.
Yeah. Okay. So email, not Wix.
Yes. Probably. But I do sometimes go on X or Twitter, whatever we want to call it. And I do, you know, accept requests and stuff like that. It's not every day for my own mental health.
All right, well,
mostly.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I've really like decreased my scrolling through X because I cannot.
The doom scrolling was like a legitimate thing.
Yeah.
It was really bad. Everything would pop up. It's like all the kids are dying from COVID. And I'm like, I'm done. I'm done. Can't do it. Like, I'm looking at my small children. I can't do it. Like, I got to get out of here. With election season coming up, I'm definitely not going to be spending a lot of time on social media. So I'm just going to go in my rabbit hole and hope for the best.
Yeah. Same. Thank you again. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys. It was so good to see you.
You too.
Bye.
Hey, thanks for listening.
Don't forget to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or iTunes, or let us know what you think of the episode by leaving us a comment on our website, thecriminologyacademy.com.
You can also follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at The Crim Academy. That's thecrimacademy.
Or email us at thecrimacademy@gmail.com.
See you next time.